The case for argument this morning is Holtz against JPMorgan Chase Bank. Mr. Berger.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Daniel Berger, and I represent Patricia Holtz, the appellants in this matter. Your Honors, SLUSA requires dismissal of a class action based on state law if, but only if, the action alleges a misrepresentation or omission of material fact, and if that misrepresentation was made in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security. In this case, in our complaint, we have not alleged a misrepresentation or omission or pled a manipulative or deceptive device at all. Thus, under this Court's jurisprudence, particularly this Court's decision in Brown against Calamos, SLUSA does not apply, and the action should not have been dismissed because there is nothing alleged and there will be no proof in this case of a misrepresentation or omission that becomes inextricably entangled with the facts or proof in this case, and that was what this Court held in Brown against Calamos. In addition, separately, under the Supreme Court's recent decision in Chadbourn and Park against Troyce, even if this action could be characterized as involving a misrepresentation or omission, that misrepresentation or omission was not made in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security. And so SLUSA does not apply for that additional reason.
Perhaps you could refer to the Act. I have SLUSA. It's not an English word. It's jargon, right? And it's a lot easier when talking to generalists to use parts of the English language.
Very well, Your Honor. We'll refer
just
to it.
Call it the Act.
The Act or the litigation. I think the Supreme Court referred to it as the Litigation Act in the Chadbourn case.
The Supreme Court has the same sensible desire to use real words that we do.
Fair enough, Your Honor. The Act in question, our complaint does not run afoul of the Litigation Act. Our complaint does not allege a misrepresentation or omission. What it does allege is a breach of fiduciary duty by J.P. Morgan in connection with establishing investment advisory relationships with its clients and then turning around and preferring its own interests.
My problem with your presentation, and I think the district judges, was that you're just using another form of words for the classic claim of omission, of a deceptive omission. Would you have a claim if the bank had stood up and said, whenever the opportunity arises, we'll prefer our own interests over yours?
Yes, we would, Your Honor, because that would be a breach of fiduciary duty. It's not waivable.
There is no breach of fiduciary duty if there's a contract that allows the other side to do exactly X.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, the contracts here did not allow J.P. Morgan to prefer its own interests, and the investment advisor...
On the hypothetical I gave you, if they had said, we will prefer our own interests over yours when the opportunity arises, then the agreement would allow them to do exactly this.
I suppose so, Your Honor, but as this Court said in the Brown case, no sane investor would knowingly put himself at the mercy of a disloyal investment advisor.
Of course not. But that just means that this case boils down to an omission to state a material fact, which the investors say affected their decision. But an omission to state a material fact is a classic securities claim.
True, Your Honor, but first of all, it didn't affect a decision. And in addition, Your Honor, any breach of contract...
You just asserted that had the omitted fact been disclosed, it would have affected your client's decision.
It would have affected...
You said it would have affected any sane client's decision.
It would have affected the decision to become an investment advisory client of J.P. Morgan, not to invest in these particular securities. And that's what the Supreme Court said recently in the Chadbourn case. It has to be material to a decision to purchase or sell particular
securities.
Do you
think they overruled Zanford as part of this decision?
Well, certainly the dissent thought so, but I would... The majority didn't think they overruled Zanford.
The majority, indeed, was written by the author of Zanford, if I recall correctly.
I believe so, Your Honor. But
he didn't think he was overruling his own case.
No,
accident.
No, and the Supreme Court, the opinion did say that we are not overruling Zanford, we're not overruling Dabbitt. But our case is not Zanford, and it's not Dabbitt. This is a case where there's a fiduciary relationship established between J.P. Morgan and its clients. And consent of the client cannot waive the fiduciary duty in this case. J.P. Morgan clients entered into account agreements and established a fiduciary relationship with their clients under New York law. And J.P. Morgan breached that duty by preferring its own interests, by deciding as a matter of policy that it would put its investment advisory clients into its own proprietary mutual funds where it could earn greater fees, irrespective of the best interests of its clients. And that is a breach of fiduciary duty, and that's a breach that we allege. And there is no misrepresentation or omission necessary to establish that claim, with all respect, under New York State law. And none will become entangled in it. This case, therefore, is different than this Court's decision against Brown against Kalamos, where clearly the kind of case that we brought is left open. In the Brown case, what the Court said is that breach of fiduciary duty cases under state law are permissible. The problem in the Brown case was that for the plaintiff to prevail in that case, they couldn't prevail on a breach of duty of loyalty claim unless they established a misrepresentation. And that's because the fiduciary there, which was the board of directors of a group of funds, could, under Delaware law, make decisions that preferred the total group of funds over any individual fund. So what the Court said in the Brown case is, in those circumstances, it may be necessary for the plaintiffs to prevail on their claim to establish that there actually was a misrepresentation.
Do you have any disagreement with the SEC's decision in the E.F. Hutton case? I suppose there have been too many E.F. Hutton cases. The E.F. Hutton Manning case?
I'm not sure I remember what the SEC's position
is. The SEC decided in the E.F. Hutton Manning case that a market maker who fails to disclose the market maker's status is in violation of securities law because that could affect the market maker's decisions about investing client funds.
Yes.
If you're right, E.F. Hutton was not properly a securities case because it's the same theory here as in E.F. Hutton. Theory in E.F. Hutton was that they needed to disclose. There was a fiduciary relationship. The fiduciary relationship required disclosure. The lack of disclosure violated the securities laws.
Yes.
That seems to be your theory, except you're not willing to state number three.
Your Honor, there is nothing here that they needed to disclose. What would they have disclosed? That we're going to act as your fiduciary, except we're not going to act as your fiduciary. We intend to be biased. We intend to be self-interested.
That's exactly what E.F. Hutton, what the SEC said in E.F. Hutton had to be disclosed. It's also the basis for the shingle theory in securities law. It's the basis for the suitability theory in securities law. There are so many strands of securities law that look a lot like your claim that
it's very
hard to understand how this can be other than a securities
law. I do appreciate that, Your Honor, but it is not necessary for us to prove or establish a misrepresentation to prevail. And if we can
it just sounds like the whole scope of the act, that one shouldn't be allowed to manufacture a state law theory that takes the law in a different direction from where federal securities law is going.
Well, Your Honor, we're not manufacturing a theory here. This is classic breach of fiduciary duty. When I go into J.P. Morgan as a client, I expect my investment advisor to act in my best interests. And if they do not do so, I guess what the Court's position hypothetically is that you could never have a breach of contract and never have a breach of fiduciary duty claim under state law brought in a class basis, because anything with an investment advisor or a broker would necessarily involve securities law.
That involves non-disclosure.
Agreed, Your Honor, but our claim does not require non-disclosure. Again, any claim...
I just don't see how you would have a claim if there had been disclosure, because then you would have a contract allowing J.P. Morgan to do what
it did. But, Your Honor, not to belabor it, but what would be disclosed? That we intend to act contrary to your best interest?
Yeah.
That's not something that's reality, Your Honor. No broker is going to disclose that. But more importantly, we don't need to prove it.
Well, maybe more specifically, as I understand your claim, it's that your clients were promised sound, disinterested investment advice when, in fact, there was this scheme, undisclosed, to steer them into the proprietary funds.
Yes, Your Honor, there's a practice to do that.
So that is There was a fraud by non-disclosure or a fraud by omission.
It's not a fraud, Your Honor. It's a practice.
It may also be a breach of contract and a breach of fiduciary duty, but all three overlap, and that's Act is intended to get at.
It may be that the claim could somehow be characterized as a scheme, but that's not the claim that we've alleged in the complaint, and that's not the claim that we've brought under state law. It is simply a breach of fiduciary duty claim. A fiduciary duty exists. It was violated by the practice of preferring their own funds, and mm-hmm. clients were damaged.
One might say that that's almost the very definition of artful pleading. Right? You have something that stares you in the face. It screams securities fraud, but our complaint doesn't use those words, and therefore we avoid the litigation.
Your Honor, we're very mindful of the many decisions, including decisions by this court, that say, with respect to SLUSA, we're not allowed to be artful pleaders.
With respect to the Act.
I apologize. It's too many times during. With respect to the Litigation Act or the Act, we're not allowed to be artful pleaders.
The problem with being a specialist. Specialists have their own lingo to talk to each other.
That's correct, Your
Honor. You have to translate it for normal legal generalists.
But with respect to the Act, it's not necessary. And I think that one of the things that the Supreme Court pointed out recently in the Chadbourne case was that the Act does not invalidate every single state law class action. There is still room for state law. And if there's room for state law, there ought to be room for, the Act allows room for state law claims based on breach of fiduciary duty or breach of contract.
Let me give you another Supreme Court case. It's the Wharf Holdings case. It says that if you make a promise with respect to a security that you intend not to keep, that's securities fraud. It's not just breach of contract, it's securities fraud. Now, your complaint seems to say they made our class a promise which they intended not to keep. They promised disinterested advice. They intended not to do that. Under Wharf Holdings, that sounds like securities fraud.
Your Honor, I don't know if they intended not to keep it when they made the promise. No, what we allege is that when they entered into the investment advisory relationship, a fiduciary duty was created. With some members of our class, that may have been years before they decided now it is in our interest to actually act in our own interest as opposed to the client's interests. So it is not the case. And, Your Honor, again, any breach of contract claim and any breach of fiduciary duty claim can always be characterized as a fraud. The fraud of the person who made the contract not to honor the contract. That would render it a nullity. That would again mean that you could never have a state law claim based on breach of contract or breach of fiduciary duty with respect to brokers or advisors or investments.
Well, you can. You just can't litigate it as a class action of more than 50.
That mm-hmm. is correct, Your Honor. You can bring individual case, you just can't litigate it as a class action. But we don't believe that that's what Congress intended under SLUSA. We don't believe that's what the decisions, including this Court's decision, say. I believe this Court's decision in Brown was fairly clear that a breach of fiduciary duty claim is permissible as long as it doesn't involve unnecessary entanglement with proving a misrepresentation and omission. And with all respect, Judge Easterbrook, to your point, in this case, we are not going to prove a misrepresentation or omission. And it's not going to come up in the course of this litigation. In addition, the second prong of the Act, which is the in connection with the purchase or sale of security, covered security, Supreme Court said in the Chadbourne case that a fraudulent misrepresentation or omission is not made in connection with the purchase or sale of a covered security unless it is material to a decision by one or more individuals to buy or sell the covered security. Unless it is material to the decision to buy or sell the covered security. In this case, the misrepresentation that we've been discussing is a misrepresentation with respect to the fiduciary relationship, not with respect to any purchase or sale of a covered security. So for that reason as well, the Act would not apply to the circumstances here. The cases that have allowed sustained dismissals of state court class actions under the Act are all cases where the plaintiffs alleged or had to allege that there was a misrepresentation that was going to be necessary for them to prevail in their case. In our case, misrepresentation or omission, to the extent there was one, is not necessary at all.
Is there any way in which this situation is interestingly different from Davitt and Kircher? If I recall Davitt and Kircher, the plaintiffs there said they weren't alleging anything other than breach of fiduciary duty, and that didn't carry the day in either Davitt or Kircher in this circuit.
I believe the Davitt case, the decision was that there were misrepresentations and omissions, but they caused the plaintiffs in that case to hold their securities. And at least at that point in time, there was, in the lower courts, there was some dispute as to whether holders...
The technical question that the Supreme Court resolved in Davitt was whether a holder action is in connection with the purchase or sale.
Yes, Your Honor.
But, of course, our decision in Kircher also resolved that claim on the merits. And the plaintiffs in the Kircher case, in all of these fast trading cases, had alleged that the defendants had a fiduciary duty to stop the fast trading by the arbitrageurs because that was injuring the long-term investors.
Yes.
And we said that was within the scope of the Act. Could we rule in your favor without overruling Kircher?
I believe so, Your Honor. I'd have to go back and look at Kircher. I know Davitt, and I know Davitt did concern misrepresentations or omissions that were part of the case, that were essential for the plaintiffs to prevail, that were
That's
involved.
That's what the Supreme Court thought. The plaintiffs themselves loudly denied that conclusion.
But I believe this.
The plaintiffs in Davitt were saying the same kind of thing that you're saying, and the plaintiffs in Kircher were saying.
Correct, but I believe that in Davitt, if there were misrepresentations or omissions that were...
That's what the judges thought, that that kind of suit couldn't succeed without showing that there was undisclosed material information, and that's why it came within securities law.
Correct.
But as you can see, you're having the same effect on the judges here. You have that effect on the district judge. Can a suit like this succeed without showing there was some undisclosed material information?
I believe our suit does succeed without showing undisclosed material information. Because what undisclosed material information do we need to show? We show that there was a relationship established. We show that there was a practice to prefer their own financial interests. We show damages. No misrepresentation.
You just characterized it a moment ago as a misrepresentation about the relationship.
To the extent to the extent we don't concede that there's a misrepresentation, but
that's the terminology you just used a moment
ago. We don't concede that there's a misrepresentation here. If there was any misrepresentation, Your Honor, it was a misrepresentation in connection with establishing the account relationship in the first place.
Yeah.
But there was no misrepresentation that forms a basis of the claim itself. Because again, not to belabor it, but the claim itself is a very simple claim. A fiduciary duty was created, a fiduciary duty was breached, and there were damages. To establish the breach, which I think is the critical point, we do not need to prove any misrepresentation. We don't need to prove anything that was said to the clients at all. It was J.P. Morgan that did the acting. It was J.P. Morgan that invested the money in their own funds in violation of their fiduciary duty. Thank you, Your Honor. So I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berger. Mr. Youngwood.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jonathan Youngwood, Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett for the defendants, and may it please the court. SLUSA has a number of requirements.
What?
Has to involve...
What has a number of requirements?
You know, I wrote
the
on
very
the pad,
first word.
I wrote on the PAD Litigation Act. I will also admit, Your Honor, I was pulling up Kircher as I was sitting there, which I know Your Honor wrote, and it does refer to something called SLUSA. But I will refer to it as the Act. I apologize. The Act has a number of requirements. It has to involve covered class action. That's not disputed here. It has to involve covered securities. That's not disputed here. What is disputed is two aspects of it, whether or not there's an untrue statement or omission of material fact in connection with the purchase or sale of security, and that's really both the elements. And there's also the aspect of a manipulative or deceptive device or contrivance, which isn't covered by the district court judge, isn't covered extensively in the briefs, but also would be a second way to walk into the Act in this case. Let me start with the whether or not we have misrepresentations or omissions. or whether or not we have manipulative or deceptive devices or contrivances. I begin and end here with the complaint. The standard here is Brown, and I'm happy to discuss Brown in some detail. But the complaint itself is what governs. And there's a history here, and we can get into the history because it's actually the third complaint. And some of the earlier complaints had phrases that this one doesn't have. But
actually, before you start focusing in on the allegations,
right.
What rule of law derives from the Brown case as you see it?
What's the standard?
Right.
Yeah. I think the standard it's right in the middle of the decision, and the standard, as the court held in that, and I know Your Honor was on that panel, is that a suit's barred by, I'll substitute in, the Act, only if allegations of the complaint make it likely that an issue of fraud will arise in the course of litigation, as in this case. There's an elaboration of the standard following, which says the allegation of fraud will be difficult and maybe impossible to disentangle from the charge of the breach of loyalty that the defendants owed their investors, and I suppose, based on that sentence, one could debate whether or not added to the standard is impossibility or difficult. I think under either interpretation we prevail here. I think there's an easy reading that all it needs to be is difficult, not impossible.
Right.
But I think that's the standard.
Well, except the panel said when it came time to actually, you know, make a decision,
right,
that under any reasonable standard this complaint fails. And so
that's
I'm
right.
not sure that this is a definitive test for the circuit,
and that there is an
impossibility or a necessity requirement.
Well, I think the panel did hold that perhaps there'd be a different result that was the Ninth Circuit's test, which allows repleting. I think it's quite clear in this case that if you agree with the district court, there's no repleting here.
Right, right.
And then there's a debate between the Third Circuit standard, the Sixth Circuit standard, and what some commentators in courts, not this court, but others have held to be a hybrid standard that was adopted in Brown.
Right, and I'm not sure we actually resolved the debate and settled
right.
on a test.
Fair enough.
But I guess it is what it is, so go ahead and apply it and go back to the complaint
sure,
if you'd
sure.
like.
And I guess I would say here that comparing the facts of this case or the allegations of this case, the allegations of Brown, I actually think this is an easier case. I'll refer to the complaint in a moment, but in Brown, you have one reference to a public statement of the fund that the court then, frankly, layers on some interpretation to and says it can be read as a misrepresentation, and it even says it can be implicitly read as an omission. You don't have to do any of that here. You know, I'll actually begin with paragraph 99. It's obviously toward the end of their complaint. Paragraph 99, defendants have been unjustly enriched through a self-dealing scheme aimed at enriching themselves at the expense of plaintiffs and other members of the class. So scheme isn't my word. Scheme is their word to describe what they're doing. It's a summary of everything that comes before, and try as they might through the history of this case that although this case began in the Northern District, the very close cousin of this case was in New York with words like fraud and words that allowed for a removal and then, frankly, a voluntary dismissal and then a decision to refile here. And you can, as we do in our brief, go through the complaint, find not just similar but identical sentences, at least one of which is word for word identical, but the word fraud's been stricken out.
Right. I mean, the litigation history is very telling, but
And I think
that's
telling
the standard.
I think telling is relevant for this analysis. As Brown writes, one of the reasons Brown concludes that you can't dismiss these things without prejudice, you have to dismiss them with prejudice, is that if you dismiss them without prejudice, they get refiled in state court or they get remanded to state court, and the plaintiff is now left to his or her devices and freedoms to elaborate. Over the course of litigation, these things are going to find their way back in. And maybe you can slightly criticize that because it requires the court to predict the future. You don't have to predict the future here. That to me is the relevance of the Trollins. They've shown you exactly how they would like to plead this, and then they've tried very hard to restrain themselves to get by the Act. And I don't think they do it. If this was the first complaint, I'd be making all these arguments. But I do have the benefit, and you have the benefit, of seeing some history here that you don't often see in these cases. In terms of what else, I've read you the conclusion of the complaint, but there's obviously a lot that comes before it. There are dozens, I think, of paragraphs that discuss actual alleged misstatements either posted on a website, in a press release, or I think significantly filed with the SEC. Filed with the SEC is required under the securities laws in the form ADV for various products that are alleged to be part of this case. There is an argument that's in the briefs, at least, that all of this is background, that somehow it can be disregarded, that it's extraneous, and that perhaps under the Third Circuit's standard it would be kicked out. But look at where they are in the complaint. First of all, they cover about 10 pages of the complaint, scattered throughout those 10 pages. But under the section they put them in the complaint is a section they've titled Substantive Allegations. So it's difficult to argue that they're background and non-essential when you've put them under your section that you call Substantive Allegations. The structure of the complaint is to lay out in that first part of that substantive allegation section, largely in paragraphs 23 through 40, all the different places where the defendant said something that was less than the truth. And then the rest of the substantive allegations is to lay out all the allegations and all the places where the defendants were at the time they were making those statements, and I think that is very clear from the complaint, were never intending to follow through with them. We obviously dispute all these facts, and that's not why we're here today, but their allegation is that there was a scheme, their word, not mine, formed in early 2008, or at least no later than early 2008, to encourage people to come to J.P. Morgan, come and give us your money, we'll do extensive due diligence. Due diligence, it's not just sort of puffery type things, we'll, you know, put you first and things like that, which themselves may be actionable in this context. That would be for another day. But it's statements of things that we're going to do due diligence, and we're going to get a properly balanced portfolio, we're going to listen to the client, we're going to do all that. And then the second half of the substantive allegations tells you at the very same time they're basically telling their financial advisors, the individual people, the broker-dealers who do this, disregard it. Don't do that at all. We're going to pay you based on how much you put into our prop funds. We're going to do all those things, but the last thing you need to do is bother yourself with the actual work. That's a scheme. That's, Judge Easterbrook, to take the point you raised in terms of did you intend to follow through at the time you brought the accounts in, or was it years later when you changed it? Maybe if it's years later, maybe we start talking about a breach of contract claim instead of this. It's not our facts. It's not the allegations, I should say. There are other cases, I think, that hold the same thing that are in our brief, which is that if you're forming a contract and you have no intention of following through on that contract, and you're, in fact, putting together a conspiracy, and let me talk about conspiracy in a second, how can it be that it's anything other than fraud?
I don't think Worf Holdings depends on conspiracy.
No, I don't think it does. I'm going beyond that. I don't think it does. The brief reference, since I raised it, I'll touch on it. Another telling thing is who they chose to sue here. They chose to sue the two parties that they allege they had contracts with, and again, I don't see the contracts. We've given them several chances to come up with them. They're are no written contracts.
It's a separate pleading issue.
It's a separate issue, but it's telling, too, as to what the nature of their claim might be. But then they've also sued the ultimate parent of J.P. Morgan Chase & Co., and they've sued the investment management component of J.P. Morgan, which is the entity charged, according to them, with actually running these proprietary funds that their clients were improperly placed into. And the reason they do it, if you read through their allegations, is because they want to tell you, they don't use the word conspiracy, I don't believe, that's my word, they want to tell you that this was something that comes from, quote, the top of J.P. Morgan, all the J.P. Morgans, that it's being run from the top, that it's being directed all across, and none of that is a breach of contract claim. That's a securities fraud case, if it's, I don't think it's that either, but if it's anything, it's that, and that's where they need to try and plead it. They need to try and plead it under 10b-5. There's a lot of reasons they didn't go that route, but if they want to, that's where they need to do. The allegations I've pointed to are in the complaint, but they don't, even before this court, walk away from them. Pages 6 and 7 of their brief, their opening brief before this court, summarizes the very same scheme. They don't use the word scheme in their brief before this court, the very same scheme that's throughout the complaint. So they're never going to walk away with it. Without it, they don't have a case. If there are no more questions on that aspect, I'll move to the in connection with and address any questions on Chadbourne, which I don't think affects this case, but I'm happy to discuss it very briefly. Chadbourne obviously is relevant. It talks about the Act. There aren't a whole lot of Supreme Court cases that talk about the Act. It came out just 6 weeks ago or so. But the facts really couldn't be more different. In Chadbourne, everyone agreed that the investors were never acquiring an interest in a covered security. In this case, everyone agrees that the case involves the investors being placed into mutual funds, which are covered securities. It's in the very first paragraph of their complaint. They've never disputed it. So on that basis alone, I mean, Chadbourne, I think, is about the stretch of how far away those covered securities need to be from the plaintiff, the alleged victim, not about, frankly, anything else. And to my colleague, you asked questions about Zandford. Chadbourne expressly, on page 10 of the slip opinion, references Zandford, says we're not walking away from Zandford. At other places, says we're not walking away from Davitt. The summary, just the parenthetical summary that's given in Chadbourne of Zandford is itself telling and shows how relevant it is to this case and how Chadbourne couldn't possibly be overturning Zandford or changing the result. The summary in the parenthetical is that the fraudster told customers he would conservatively invest their money in the stock market and made sales of his customers' securities but pocketed the proceeds. That's not very different than this exact case. It's a 15-word summary, but it's a change a few words there and you have this exact case. So the notion that Chadbourne in any way affects this court's jurisprudence, general SLUSA jurisprudence, the Gavin case, which we haven't discussed, but I'd be happy to, which is one of this court's decisions on the in connection with requirements, something that they've referred to in their briefs, but again, it is quite distant factually, and nothing in the language of the decision would suggest that there's something that would cause these facts to trouble the Gavin court. Chadbourne doesn't really change anything at all. I'm happy to continue. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I'm also happy, if having covered those two points, to cede my time back. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Youngwood. Anything further, Mr. Berger?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, we agree that the controlling standard in this case is provided by the Brown case. And what the Brown case held is that if fraud is unlikely to be an issue that arises at trial, if it is not going to be inextricably tangled up with the proof, then the Act does not forbid the state court claim, in this case based on breach of fiduciary duty. And we strongly disagree with our adversary that we have alleged misrepresentation or even a scheme. The references in the complaint to the words used by J.P. Morgan are what they told their clients about the fiduciary duty to establish the fiduciary duty. It's not a representation that we're suing on in this case. And in addition, the fact that the orders to violate the fiduciary duty came from on high at J.P. Morgan, again, does not involve a misrepresentation or omission or any course of conduct that operates as a fraud that we will have to prove in this case. I know I'm repeating myself, but I believe that...
Can I...
Yes.
I just want to pin down one thing you said in your opening argument. I asked what would happen if the defendants had disclosed what you say are their actual practices of preferring their own interests. And you said that that would be irrelevant. State law doesn't allow them to contract out of the duty that you believe they have. Am I correctly understanding your argument?
Yes. State law does not allow.
Maybe it's a bad idea to ask you this, but did you happen to read the opinion in Northwest against Ginsburg, which the Supreme Court released an hour ago?
It would be wonderful if I could say yes, Your Honor. It would be great. But I have not. But I assume Your Honor has.
The Supreme Court dealt with a statute which preempted state law claims, except state law claims resting on contract. And it then had to decide what state law claims rest on contract. And it defined as a state law claim resting on contract that set of legal rules that could be contracted out of. Anything you can't contract out of, the Supreme Court said, is not a contract claim. It sounds like you are identifying your suit as not resting on contract, at least as the Supreme Court understood a contract claim in Northwest against Ginsburg.
I obviously, Your Honor, can't speak to what the Supreme Court understood.
I'm hardly blaming you for not having some direct teletype of the Supreme Court to you. And I'll give both sides 2 weeks to file supplemental memos addressing the bearing of Northwest against Ginsburg on this litigation. That is the Supreme Court's definition of non-preempted contract claims, to see whether, not only how it applies to this case, but whether that definition should carry over to the Litigation Act. That seems to me an interesting question.
That was going to be my reaction, Your Honor. I don't know the statute that they were dealing with in that case,
it's not your fault.
we're not writing on a clean slate. We have many Supreme Court decisions interpreting the Act and many decisions of this Court interpreting the Act. Mm-hmm. And the language of the Act is clear.
I'm raising this because one possibility for a rule that would distinguish the genuine contract claims that survive preemption by the Litigation Act from other claims that disguise securities law claims might be what the Court used under the Airline Deregulation Act in Northwest against Ginsburg. That is, it's the set of claims that are fully contractable, where parties have full power over contract to do what they wish, and state law doesn't get in the way. And then, as soon as somebody stands up and says, I've got a claim where the state just wouldn't allow a contract, now you're within the scope of preemption. But maybe that's wrong, right? It's only decided an hour ago. I haven't had time to think about it thoroughly either.
I would never... Your Honor, I don't know what to say about that, but I do know that this Court's decision in Brown does allow for the possibility of breach of fiduciary duty claims. It's clear from the decision.
Maybe Northwest should lead us to rethink that, but maybe not.
Perhaps I
don't have any position on that. I'm throwing it out so the parties can address it.
I would argue not, Your Honor, because the language of this statute is quite clear. And I see that my time is up, so thank you, Your Honors, very much.
And we will accept supplemental memos within 14 days addressing the parties' views on the bearing, if any, of Northwest against Ginsburg on this question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.